brought Bumble Dex to the party.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 92 of the PDH Pod, the one and only Magic the Gathering podcast dedicated to the total exploration of the Pauper Commander format. This week, we've brought a very special guest onto the show to talk about a topic that hopefully casual and competitive players can both jive with, and that is what goes into playtesting and patching weaknesses in your various Pauper Commander decks. I am your host, Brad Drack V, but first, let's see what my co-hosts from the East Coast are up to. First up, fresh off an appearance from Sanctuary 4, is Dave the Alcadron Vader. How was your weekend?
My weekend was remarkable. I loved it. I'm very happy to tell you more about how that went and what my experience was like. But first, I have grievances, and the grievances are...
Okay, let's hear it.
The filthy 14-year-olds got me sick again.
Come on.
I don't know how it keeps happening. I do know how it keeps happening. Within the last week... Well, partly I work in a school, but like within the last week, I have given blood, gotten tattooed, and had a bunch of dental work done. So my whole body is like recovering.
Your whole body's like
on like three different fronts. And then when the mild cold showed up, my body was like, you know what?
I give up.
Take it.
I'm out.
Take it.
Peace, idiots.
That's it.
I'm out of here. Yep. Your immune system is on strike. Get rest.
So you've brought it on yourself this time, is what I hear.
I kind of did. On the plus side, my tattoo is remarkable.
Is it? Is it a new one, or is the big one still getting worked on?
The big one's still getting worked on. There was a strip of no color kind of down the back of my arm, which weirdly is like, it's the part of my arm that I can't see without a mirror.
Correct.
It's like the back, the part that's completely invisible to me. So
For
the last, 7 months... Before that work was done, like every time I look down at my arm, I'm like, "Oh yeah, it's basically finished."
But why not?
We had a long appointment where he tattooed a bunch of stuff that I can't normally see. But like now, every time I look in the mirror, I'm like, "Oh yeah, I don't have that strip of black and white, like empty space without color on the back of my arm anymore, and it looks really cool."
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Sounds like a good time. Oh, next up. We got our resident PDH PhD, Liam. How was your weekend? You're sort of fresh off the event as well.
Yeah, I'm fresh off the event in a different way, different capacity.
Yeah, different capacity, yep.
It was definitely a day. I don't know how to phrase this. It was the busiest sanctuary I've had to do so far.
It was. It really was. Like, just from the commentator booth before my internet crashed, like, I could just see you hopping around from room to room, table to table. Like, you'd come in with us into the booth a little bit, and then you'd be dragged away to answer some more questions.
Yep.
Like, it was a very busy judge day.
Yeah, and I think my favorite judge call of the whole day, it happened about halfway through, I think, but it was they did the at judge thing, and I was like, oh, okay, something to do. You know, it was a bit of a lull. And they're like, hey, and I was like, hey, before we get started, I can only see one of you. And their immediate response was, perfect, that's why you're here. And I was like, oh no.
That's something that doesn't happen in person, hopefully.
I'm like, y'all do realize that we're 30 minutes into a digital tournament, right? And they were like, yeah, we know. And I was like, okay.
Alrighty.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a quick fix, As soon as the video disconnect happened, like they were all still connected with audio, so it was a spell table end issue. Just had it all refresh, and they were all good to go.
You didn't like have to restart the game or anything?
No. They reached out, like two of them immediately as soon as the disconnect happened, like paged me. So, you know, from the moment they paged me to the time they were all back in the pod, I think was like less than a minute, maybe less than 90 seconds. So. I wasn't too terribly worried about it. Everyone agreed that it all looked good, and we moved on. But it was just like...
Yeah, spell table's been pretty finicky lately.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with spell table. I found it a little strange and weird that, like, to be a spectator, I had to have my camera on.
Yeah,
Why did my camera have to be on for spectator mode? I mean, easy enough to just block it over, but it's just like, that's strange. That shouldn't be a thing ever anywhere. So, yeah. But overall, it was great.
Yeah, it's a good time. I was in the commentator booth with Derek, a little bit with Bobby, and then, like I mentioned, my internet crashed out, so I didn't even get to watch the final round, pretty much, let alone commentate it. But Dave filled in, and apparently the final round was pretty good. Papa Popper won with Third Path Iconoclast. How was that game? I'm assuming it was longer than three turns this time.
Yeah, it did go much more than three turns.
Good deal.
There were some decisions. Yeah. Some.
Oh my gosh! I'm gonna, I think the last two trademark turns of the game.
some decisions trademark were made. Okay. And they were made decisively.
Oh.
And then they were evaluated decisively. And it was interesting.
That's a lot of deciding things going on. Things being made by decision.
I think if anyone that goes back and watches the VOD, I mean, it was a very long day for all those players. But I think if anyone goes back and watches the VOD, I think the game could have ended like two turns earlier.
I have not. Possibly. Still bookmarked or whatever. I have not.
Might have just been one turn earlier, the final game. But yet. I know that the game could have ended much sooner than it did. And so it was just like, it's like, yeah, we're still going.
We're still chilling. Taking that, some games.
Taking that no time limit thing pretty seriously though, huh?
I mean, the last one ended on turn three. We have to compensate.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's right. We gotta go the other direction.
Stretch this one out a little bit longer.
Yep. Yeah, not just in time limit, but decks too. Like the last one was very combo heavy. This tournament was very mid range heavy. Like it was nice. It was nice to see that sort of like jump in player decisions, decks being played, and everything. And it was like almost twice the size of the last one too. So that was awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it was a good time. Good weekend had by all. Dave.
Yo.
Who we got in the studio with us?
I would like to welcome to the studio for the first time.
The very first
famed tournament winner, Mizu, who did not win the Sanctuary. We are approximately one tournament behind current events. Mizu is the champion of our Common Cause event that happened a month or so back. I don't know. Time is fake. Took down that whole event with a very cool Scholar of the Ages list. Which was super impressive for me to watch because I hung out a lot with Corkin while he developed sort of the first draft of the competitive scholar list, and I just sort of watched it never really come together for a long time.
Yeah.
He was trying to make it a very control list, and then I was completely blindsided by Mizu's performance with this new like turbo combo scholar version.
I think a lot of people were not. I mean, obviously not just the players at the event, but like sort of the community at large.
Yeah, I was,
because I think everybody had that same view on it. It was, oh, you know, it's a combo deck, but it just never really got there. We're waiting on some new tech or what have you.
I think everyone had that view of it except Mizu.
Correct.
And Gator. Like, yeah. Gator, the last time Gator was on our show, he was like, this is one of the, you know, one of the gatekeepers. Like, if your deck can't handle Scholar, then it's not going to succeed in the competitive realm. And I was like, ah, I bet he's exaggerating. No, turns out Gator actually knows a thing or two about Magic the Gathering.
Crazy. Every so often.
Wild. I'm sorry, what?
I said every so often he does.
Every so often he
every
does.
So often, yeah.
So, yeah. Welcome, Mizu.
How's it going?
I actually don't know your real name.
I do not either.
Good. You don't need to.
I'd like it that way.
All right, this guy's name is Mizu.
Actually, I just made a comment about that the other day about how I don't respond to my actual name very much anymore.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess quick follow-up on that. Is this the Japanese word for water, or is this some other connection that I'm not missing?
Yes.
Or that I am missing?
So the
Japanese
full name,
word for water.
The full name is Mizu-san, which whenever I was a wee little lad, I was a huge Monster Hunter player. And when I was forced to come up with a name for my online profiles, my favorite monster in the game was Mizutsune.
Mizutsune, yeah.
And I just took off a couple letters to make it work for the...
Perfect.
Perfect. Works out great.
And I'm too far in that. Now.
Too far in to change it now, yep.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Before we get to the main topic, let's do a little bit of housekeeping. If you like the show and you like what we're doing here, as usual, you can support us over on Patreon at patreon.com/thepdhpod, just like Mizu does. very much appreciated. By being a patron, you get access to the pre-show, which is basically like almost like another episode every week of the crew. And, you know, if we have any guests on, just sort of like catching up for the week, working out show notes, chit-chatting, talking pretty much anything that comes up. And those are usually like an hour or so long. It's a good time there, and I post those directly to Patreon. You also get early access to the episodes before they go live, usually the night before. And I also post the show notes so you can sort of follow along with what we're talking about if you're into that sort of thing. Finally, you get access to the PDH Pod Discord server where you can chat with Mizu himself, you can chat with the crew, you can get help with your decks, you can hear about my daily work adventures, all that sort of thing. And then, let's see here, you can also support the show by picking up some custom gaming products, currently some play mats over on inkedgaming.com. If you go to the collections, with a PDH Pod, but basically it's inkedgaming.com/collections/artist-the-PDH-pod. We're going to probably work on some more stuff to put up there pretty soon. But right now we got some playmats on there you can check out. And if you want to leave us a little voice message or listener question that we can play on the show, you can find us over at speakpipe.com/thePDHpod. And then lastly, just check out our YouTube and Twitch channels. The latter, we're just the PDH Pod on both of those platforms, but the latter is where I stream Spell Table Pauper Commander every Saturday evening, usually about 5 p.m. unless there's a major tournament going on like there was this past Saturday. And I think that pretty much does all the good housekeeping for us. What's this week in Magic look like, Liam?
This week in Magic is actually pretty uneventful. All we really had...
Yeah, pretty light.
Yeah, pretty light too. All we really had was the OTJ story began being dropped. I think it began a bit last week, and then it began more this week. I guess the word is continued. Man, these middle schoolers are really rubbing off on me. Like, it's been bad recently.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
They're all getting that spring fever, going crazy.
And, I mean, there's that, but no, I just mean like I don't know, like my general like vocabulary has decreased significantly.
Yeah.
Not much. It's really just been OTJ story. Like I scoured for something, any amount of discourse or whatever, but like it really has been pretty empty. Nice.
Yeah, I was nice little checking out the mothership, checking out Twitter, and there's just not a whole lot going on. Some like Morrow's spoiler teaser thing came out on his blog, that sort of stuff.
Even then, but like nothing on there was like egregious, right? Like,
no, it really wasn't.
And that's the thing is like those things are usually like super duper popular, but like. And
there's usually like 2 to 4 of those things on that list that like Twitter and social media like gloms on and talks about until the cards are revealed. But I didn't really see much of that this time.
Right. Like I think the biggest thing was a dual lands with a land subtype that has never been on duels mm-hmm. before. And so, you know, people are thinking it's going to be the desert type, which would make sense with a Wild West. I saw someone put out their bid that it's going to be the mine type from Urza's Mine. We're going to get a cycle of mines. I think that would be different and funny.
That would be funny.
But like, yeah, like just looking through, it's like the biggest thing is like the gathering of all the MTG villains. Like, you know, we were like, oh, you know, they'll put 3 or 4 on the plane. Mm-hmm. No, they're like pulling from everywhere. They're pulling from Dominaria and Eldraine and Fiora and Innistrad and Ixalan and Kaladesh and Kaldheim and Kamigawa and Capenna and Ravnica. It's just like, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
This is like actually like a big thing. So it's just like, yeah, you know, this is pretty neat. And none of the type lines were like super obnoxious. I mean, there's a new creature type called Mount, whatever the heck that is. But like
Horsemanship 2.0?
No, it's like it's sort of like reverse. What's the thing from the new Dominaria set?
Wait, have we seen a Mount code?
There's been leaks of it. It's like the new
I don't want to talk about a leak.
Saddle.
It's like Enlist.
Enlist, yes. That's the Dominaria mechanic that wanted to be banding.
Oh, okay.
It's like It's like reverse Enlist.
Okay.
Okay.
But I
actually liked Enlist, but
I think Enlist is really cool.
It is cool. It's a little awkward because the creature you're enlisting can't be summoning sick. Like, it's plays out a little weird, but I do like it quite a bit.
Right. But even then, like, you know, I look at, like, the type lines even further. It's like legendary core advisor, legendary giant scout. Like, these are pretty unique type lines. I don't think we've ever had
pretty straightforward.
We've never had a core advisor. I think there's been, like, one or two giant scouts from Lorwyn, but like, not a legendary one. It's like, they're neat, they're new type lines, but, like, nothing too out of this world. I think the he gave us some card names from the set, and they get a little cutesy, but
yeah, a little punny.
Nothing that's like, you know, in early 2000s Magic, most of these probably would have been in an unset. In
yes, 100%.
In late 2010s Magic, like, you know, 2017, 2019, I'd say about 50-50 chance some of these would have been in a main set, some of them would have been in an unset. In this day and age, I mean, that
in the age of Morrow and his squirrels,
in the age of fire design and black border infinity cards, this is just what it is now.
Pretty much
for better or for worse.
Right,
but yeah, like even some of these lines of rules text just aren't.
There was nothing that like jumped off the page.
Strange, yeah. Right? So yeah, what, you know?
Yeah, there was the only one that I really saw that interested me was the one that, and I know we've had at least one card printed like this before, but it said, you know, can't be cast during your first, second, or third turn.
Yeah, there's some like angel that. From like, the I cast.
Thought that was, yeah, yeah, I thought that was pretty neat.
I love that Sarah Avenger.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Say from Time Spiral. It was one of my favorite cards in Time Spiral.
Sure.
The one that popped out to me was the new modal mechanic that introduces something different to think about. I'm kind of intrigued to see what that means. But, like, other than that and whatever potential rules headache it'll be, this looks like this kind of looks like where it's like we're going to do a Wild West set, which is a setting that we said we would never ever do.
100%.
And we're going to, like, be very flavorful about it, but none of the designs are going to be too messy. Right? Like we don't want to overload them with, like, flavor and design, you know, just one or the other. So I think they went really heavy on the flavor, but the design is kind of not playing it safe, but playing it regular. Right. So
yeah, pretty straightforward. Yeah.
I'm intrigued to see how this is going to go. I really am.
Yeah. I guess we'll find out in about 3 weeks.
As long as they give us some sort of sharpshooter, I will be happy.
Didn't we just get that for Fallout?
Yeah, but that's Fallout flavor, not in-universe flavor.
It's not in-universe Wild West Tombstone flavored. Sweet. Well,
I don't
thank
know
you for
what
that.
In-universe means anymore.
I want Vraska in a cowboy hat with a sniper rifle.
All right.
Well, you just might get it. We'll find out here in a few weeks, I guess. Cool. I actually did lie. We're going to get to the main topic. But first, just like we do with all of our guests, Mizu-san, for the listeners that don't somehow know who you are or the PDH community members that somehow have never talked to you, try to give them a little bit of your history with the game and what ultimately brought you to the Pauper Commander side of things.
So, I'm Mizu. I've been playing since the original Theros block, and I've moved into PDH about 3 years ago when the big push for Commander got a little too powerful for me.
Fair.
The way that a lot of Commander games ended up with me, for me, was too many Wraths, not enough combat, every game ended in a combo, and PDH was just a different way that felt more like old school limited.
Yeah, it had the opposite of all those things.
PDH started off as something very casual for me and has since developed into me being a huge CPDH player, constantly jamming games on Sanctuary.
Yeah, going to be a grinder.
I think I need to make it to my second event before I become a grinder.
That's fair.
Unfortunately, did not get to play in Sanctuary 4, but Sanctuary 5.
Yep.
Watch out. We have a date for Sanctuary 5. It's May 11th, I think, right?
Do we really?
Did he confirm it?
He did not confirm it. He he suggested a date to the three of us that were in that call, and then said he would confirm it closer to end of April.
I have no memory
like
of this.
Sounds like Alk just confirmed it.
I have no memory of this conversation. I just was looking at my calendar the other day, and I saw the PDH Pod event calendar had Sanctuary 4 or Sanctuary 5 on May 11th, and I was like, "Oh, that must be official."
Yeah, I know that he's talked about doing it in May, but he had like I don't think he had come out and made the official Sanctuary comment.
So Liam is now adding the word tentative to that calendar.
there we go.
To that calendar activity.
Smart.
Because Dave was in that call, but apparently, you know,
man,
fell asleep.
He had a long day of how'd you phrase it? Getting your face kicked
getting
in.
Getting my face caved in.
I believe caved in. I believe the only thing confirmed is that there will be another Sanctuary before the end of June.
Yes.
And the tentative date is early May.
And we did get confirmation on the next Common Cause as well.
Yes, the next Common Cause is April 27th. That is for real. That has been announced.
Correct. Cool. I don't think I've ever asked Mizu, do you have a particular... Because I've seen you play and brew and talk about all kinds of different archetypes and decks and color pairs and whatnot. Do you have a favorite, like favorite guild or favorite color pair or favorite just generic like type of deck you like to play?
Abzan. If we could only get more Abzan commanders.
Dude, preach.
If we had more than one Abzan commander, it would be over. Mizu would not have to build any more decks.
What have you decided to do with your Armament Core deck? How did you build it?
It became this kind of mid-rangey value pile that used all of these cyclers to make sure that your mana base is fixed because it's a three-color deck.
Yeah,
and then
totally.
Ran every single way to reanimate them or put them back in your hand to just cast.
I love that.
Beautiful.
Yeah, very Abzan toolbox. I love that kind of build.
And because you're in green, you get to run all of the cool ramp spells like Three Visits and Nature's Lore that help you to grab these new dual lands.
Yeah.
It takes forever to get started. And you spend the first like 7 or 8 turns just making sure your mana's good.
Yeah, just fixing your mana. Yeah. Three color problems there.
But if you've never had a generous int and then had Armament Core enter and give it 2 counters, that's a large tree.
Pretty awesome to me. That is a very large tree. Yep,
trees indeed. Are hard.
All right, cool. Well, that main topic I mentioned a couple times has finally come to fruition. Whether you've brewed some new decks or you're playtesting something you saw on Moxfield that you never heard of, or even if it's like, you know, an established list, like, oh, you heard Papa Pauper took down the Sanctuary event with TPI. So you get on, you want to see what his deck's all about. You want to play test it, maybe copy it or build it for yourself. There was always room to work on it. Like Magic players, like at least as far as I'm concerned, a deck is never done. Someone's always fiddling with it. Even in 60 card formats, someone's always fiddling with the sideboard for, you know, that extra 1% in a matchup or what have you. And that's pretty much what we're here to talk about today. I mean, not the 60-card side of it. But we're here to talk about the wins, the whys, and the hows to do just that. Go ahead.
One of my proudest accomplishments in my entire history of playing PDH and being a part of this community is when I was tinkering with Yalaran's Is It Guildmage list. Mm-hmm. And what's notable here is that Yalaran is orders of magnitude smarter than me and a better deck builder. And I was like,
hell of a primer.
Amazing. And he had, at the time, he had this Is It Guildmage list that was on two of the combo lines. He was on the Flicker lines and he was on the Hidden Strings lines. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I trust you that these are the best ones, but I want to experiment with the others just to see how they feel. And so I put in the arcane lines and I put in the dramatic reversal lines and I was playing with this deck. And after he played against my deck a couple times, he was like, I was wrong. I need to be on the dramatic reversal lines as well. And I was like, oh, amazing. Here we go. Like
you did it.
I don't think I've ever been more proud of my CPDH performance than in that game. And like, I think I only won that one game with the tech, but it was like,
couldn't have come at a better time, huh?
Yeah. I impressed Yalaran, and that is that's something that I'm gonna very happily take to my grave with me. I'm getting buried.
I have a sticker in my book that says I impressed Yalaran.
Yeah, exactly.
a very nice sticker.
That is my contribution to Brad's. You can always tinker more with the deck.
Yeah, 100%. In keeping with our usual, you know, sort of protocol for doing episodes, we didn't necessarily pick a structure for the main topic, so we're just going to get right into it. The first little bullet point here, and I'll just, like, pass this out to the table. I guess we can all kind of give our various answers to it, have a nice little discussion. You have a deck. You've played it. You're happy with it. It's successful enough for you to be happy with it. It may not be taken down every single tournament. You may just have fun at a casual table with it. But there's always going to be times where you want to change the cards in that list. So basically, why are you changing cards in a list? Are you doing it just because you're tired of looking at the cards in the deck? Are you doing it for a particular reason? I'll throw it to you, Liam, first. And why would you change a card that's already in the deck that seems to be performing decently?
So I'm a notably bad player. I would take a card out that's performing decently because it's performing too well.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
For example,
you're too good. Too good.
Amazing.
I'm struggling to come up with a PDH example that isn't just like Oubliette.
Sure.
But like examples of this card in other of these types of cards in other formats might be things like a Dockside Extortionist or Cyclonic Rift in EDH, right? Things that are just generically good.
Yeah.
I like to stray away from those. Good example. I understand they have their place. In certain decks, and I understand that maybe I am building with those cards in mind intentionally, but you know, and as I translate that to PDH as well, it's like, you know, I'm a big Voltron player. I have like three Voltron decks. I try to make sure that each one is different, and that means like that often means that if a card is in one of them, it can't be in the other two. So even if it is a good card, right, I want as little overlap as possible. That way each deck feels unique. So
yeah, it feels like its own entity.
Yeah, and there were certainly colorless equipment that deserved to be in all three, such as, you know, Vorak Battlehorns. But I don't want it in all three. Natural, I want each deck to feel unique. I don't want there to be a single equipment I'm digging for, tutoring for, whatever. So when it comes down to it, really is like, what am I trying to get out of the game, right? Like, am I, you know, the game starts at deck building.
Right.
And so it's where do I want to go? What experience do I want to have? And is this card choice appropriate for that? That's why I would take out a card that is performing well, because it just doesn't fit what the deck is trying to do.
Yeah, that's actually a different approach that I wasn't even fully expecting. So I like that quite a bit. I'll throw it to my guest, Mizu. What makes you take a card in, put a card out of a deck, shake it all about? What are you doing?
One of the biggest reasons for me, particularly, is new cards. New cards are hot new tech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love whenever I put a deck list in, like, the PDH deck help channel that you can find on the PDH Pod Patreon Discord. And I go, hey, I'm done with this list. Is there any other things that I missed? And having, I don't know, Brad pull out a card that came out in 2011.
That happens sometimes. Yeah, it's hard to keep up with the amount of cards that are available in our format sometimes. So it's always good to have a group around you that'll mention stuff, look over your decks, give you feedback and all that sort of thing. What about you, Dave? When are you changing? I don't typically hear you talk about changing decks a whole lot. Or maybe I just miss it.
I'm not sure what to do with that statement. I will echo what Mizu said. Every time I feel like I've talked a dozen times about my entire exhausting months-long process of updating every deck I own every time a new set comes out. So like I'm doing that. Like when we get shiny new toys, I want to play with the shiny new toys. I have all of the patience and attention span of a 3-year-old when it comes to doing stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Pull Echo, that it's our big sort of impetus for me to change cards. Other decks,
I should rephrase that. I don't hear you or see you posted in the Discord like, hey, what do you think about this card in this deck? It's all of a sudden just like, a new set's out. I'll be back in a few days. I'm updating 100 decks.
Right. So, yeah, I tend to not, like, for me, deck building is not a social activity. It's something that I want to do, like, by myself in my own head. I kind of don't like it when I have like input from a bunch of different sources, because I want my decks to feel like uniquely and distinctively mine. So I try to avoid like soliciting advice from other people about that, and it's very much just a, like, I'm going to sit in my space and do the thing. And then like when I've done the thing, you know, like Bobby, bless his heart, already gets, you know, 700 Moxfield notifications every time I go into it. and like right. doesn't need me to pop into Discord and be like, hey, I updated a thing, what do you guys think? Like I can skip all of that. So like that's probably why you're not hearing about it much. But it is something that I do with some frequency. If it's not because of hot new tech, it is that like there's two other things that are big drivers of this, and one of them is that I can give really clear examples of is when the meta game changes. So
sure.
My first ever CPDH deck that I built was Bird Horse, and at the time the meta that I played in was Crash Yalaran Mentir, which is very
That's a meat grinder.
It's a slog. Everyone is playing very slow combo control decks. It was Tetiovas and Izzet Guild Mages and Toasts and Pyrsight Marrows, and you know everyone's deck is 40 pieces of interaction and then draw spells and then how to find your combo.
Right.
And so I built Bird Horse for that, and at the time, like, Bird Horse was the aggro deck of that format. I didn't have to worry about getting steamrolled by gut tokens. And I didn't have to worry about
it was a simpler time.
Yeah. So like I built the only thing I needed in that deck was 50 counter spells. Like, I needed counter spells to protect my bird from Witness Protection and Tamiyo's Completion. Right. And I needed counter spells to stop other people's Ghostly Flickers and Peregrine Rigs. And, like, that was the entire deck. And then, you know, the meta obviously is very different now. It's, like, there's a lot more competitive decks than just the Tetiovas, the Izzet Guild Mages. Like, people are now running, you know, Conrad decks with 15 Fleshbag Marauders. And people are running gut decks that will steamroll a Bird Horse, like, aggressively. Like, Bird Horse isn't the aggro deck of the format anymore. Bird Horse is very much a tempo control deck that's going to win on turn, like, 7. Right. Gut's going to kill you on turn 4. Like, you can't just sit around. Like, my deck had zero creatures in it 4 years ago.
Yeah, I remember you saying something about that. And yep, like you just now recently added creatures.
Yeah, within the last couple of years, I've been trying to find ways to like keep the counterspell density really high, but like I need to add Thraven Inspectors, Novice Inspectors, Hard Evidence,
right,
Craven Inspector. You know, I need to like I put in the Bulwark, Coastal Bulwark. I think is an outstanding blocker.
It really is.
That lets me spend my mana at the end of a turn cycle where I've kept my mana up for counter magic. If I don't have to use the counter magic, this lets me use the mana to fix my top deck. Like these are, and it blocks gut tokens. It and something else blocks gut tokens, and it'll it'll blank a flesh bag. It'll save my bird. You know, Recruit the Worthy, I think, is probably the best card in the deck.
Oh, so good, clutch.
You know, regarding meta changes.
Sure.
And then Life Link is the other one. The Spirit Link and Life Link auras. Just slap that on a bird, gain 4 life a turn. Like that's like the meta is now like some matchups are punishing enough that I need that extra life. And like all of these cards have come at the expense of like other draw spells or counter spells, and like that's okay. The meta has shifted. I don't need 50 counter spells anymore.
Right.
35 is enough.
35 is enough instead. And some way to get back that life from those skeleton tokens.
Yeah. So like that I think is a great example of the meta shifting drastically out from under my feet and me trying to chase it with the Bird Horse deck.
Right, and that deck was able to adapt and evolve, and I like that quite a bit.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, early this Izzet Guild Mage. Izzet Guild Mage is a deck that I have not adapted or evolved at all. Like Izzet Guild Mage is another deck in which I run zero creatures. And like I've tried, I played it, back in the old, combo control meta plenty of times, and it was super fun. Loved it there. Like, I tried to take it into the new meta a couple times. I just get absolutely steamrolled with this deck. People just kill as a guild mage, and then they kill me. Like the guild mage is a threat, I'm a threat, and the format is fast enough. Like, in order to make this deck, in order to overhaul this one, I would need to change 40 cards in it.
Yeah,
to make it relevant again,
and sizable like, portion of the deck.
I just don't want to do that. Like I might.
Yep. You might just start a new deck at that point.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one where I've looked at what needs to change to make it meta relevant again, and I've decided that I'm not doing any of that. So it has remained in its very fossilized. fossilized is the right word for that. Like, just hasn't
that's
changed.
A good word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
archaeologists will find it and be like, oh, a relic from 2019. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Like,
fascinating.
Yeah. So this this metagame shifts is a great way to also talk about the other important bullet point. I didn't write this, but it's perfect. Weaknesses in the deck. How do you find the weaknesses? How do you patch the weaknesses? The meta shifting on you is a great way to find these weaknesses.
And
it's also a great way to like exploit weaknesses. Like if you think the meta is going a certain direction and you're like, I bet I know what will throw a wrench in that meta, like bring it. Like, yes. You can single-handedly shift the meta 100% just by,
encouraged.
Like,
yep.
I tried to do that at Sanctuary. Didn't work great, but, like, my deck did things all day
it
long.
It worked well enough to terrify people, so that's good.
Yeah. There was one game where I was just sitting on eight lands with nothing but my commander in play, and my opponent had Conrad and Pestilence online in play, about to untap with eight swamps, and based on what my deck had done in the last couple turns... Someone was looking at my board with only my commander, being like, that guy's the threat. I'm going to attack him 13 and counter his spells. And, like, that was a terrible decision. But, like, it is indicative of how impactful my deck was in that game. So, right. I did things. I feel like I identified what I thought was a weakness in the meta. I tried to exploit it. I felt like I was very impactful. It feels weird to say
that. I feel like you're underplaying it, underselling it a little bit. Like, nobody knew what this deck was.
Right.
You didn't play it on my stream. You didn't play it on Lopert's stream. You didn't play it on Chris's stream. Like, you just sort of play tested it. I don't know if you, like, played it in real life somewhere.
Goldfished it.
Yeah. And you just sort of took it to a competitive event, you know, almost in the blind and terrified people with it, basically. That's yeah. Super impressive to me.
Well, it if you look at just the standings, you're going to look at it and be like, oh, Dave O-4'd it. That deck was a catastrophic failure. I think that it was not. I think that, like Brad said, a lot of people were very... Like, I lost games because people saw me doing stuff and they got really spooked and they murked me. So, like, it's not... I didn't lose because my deck underperformed. I think I lost because my deck overperformed and people were like, that's a problem. I need to stop that. And, right.
And what was the commander, just for the listeners?
I call him Tony Lizzuto, but the name of the magic card is Death Rattle Oni. It's a 7-mana 5/4 with flash in mono black. It has a Dargo-ish cost reduction, where it costs 2 less mana for each creature that has died, which means that if you're casting it for the second time when it would normally cost 9 mana, you can reduce that down to a single black pip with a Innocent Blood or a Fleshbag Marauder.
Right.
So it's always going to be really cheap. And it has a second ability, which is, when it comes into play, you can destroy all other creatures that have been dealt damage.
How often did that come into play? I looked at your deck list and there was a lot of dry spells, Pestilence, Crypt Rats, that sort of thing. So there was a constant effect.
Yeah. There was a game, I played a game with Mizu and Magus of the Jank, and I think Eevee Shine was in this one as well.
I'm about to say, I definitely wasn't in that pod. I wasn't at the event.
Sorry, did I say Mizu? Magus, Lobbert, and Eevee Shine. I apologize. And Magus was on... Itch Tekic and Malcolm, and he had a board. I think his board was like 36 or 37 power, and he was attacking everyone. And like during his combat step, I was like, I'll activate Pestilence a couple times. I'll play this demon, and I will kill all three of your 10/10 creatures. And he was like,
having flash is so powerful on this commander.
It completely blinded him. Like, blindsided him. He was like, the demon does what? And I was like, all your 10/10s are dead. And he was
sorry
like,
sorry for you.
What? Like, everything is dead. You just played a damnation with flash on
get
my
wrecked.
Combat step?
And developed
Pauper?
A 5/4.
And, and I have a 5/4.
And you have a 5/4.
It was pretty severe. It did things. Super fun.
Yeah. I didn't want to get super sidetracked, but I just wanted the good people out there to hear about it. I thought it was cool.
To hear about the spice that he teased us with.
Yeah. Right. This is a deck I developed because based on what I've seen from the other competitive tournaments that have happened recently, I feel like decks that are not running enough interaction is the weakness in the meta right now. I think, and I think that Ryan capitalized on this as well. He brought a mid-range deck with lots of control, lots of interaction elements that, like, developed its board while doing the interaction and shutting people down and killing the creatures. Like, that's what TPI does best. Ryan brought this to the thing, and he steamrolled the whole thing.
Yep.
And I was trying to do similar things, and I did them while losing games. So I had a good time. Weirdly, I built this deck because I thought that it would just savagely curb stomp TPI.
Uh-huh.
Because dry, like, what?
Dry spell, yeah.
Dry spell, right. Yep. Never played against TPI.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Excellent little breakdown. Back to the bullet points. Where were we exactly? Weaknesses in a deck? I think that's where we...
Yep. We're patching weaknesses.
I did want to ask, this was something I was thinking about, this particular question or bullet point, the weaknesses in a deck. Looks like Mizu in here typed, so I'll start with you, Mizu. You typed, how do you find weaknesses? I typically, like for me, it's almost a routine. If I'm playing a deck that I just built, usually a brew, maybe I'll see one online that I think is cool, so I'll build whatever I have of it in paper and then add in the rest. I almost always, almost religiously, and I didn't even think about it until we started talking about the topic for this episode, I will play a brand new deck 3 times before I change anything, and then the very first thing I change is the mana base. Basically, those first 3 times are just like dry runs, see what the mana does, then I can identify those problems, and then after that, then I can start picking apart the actual spells, the mana rocks, the creatures, and that sort of thing. Is it? How do you go about finding the weaknesses in a deck you play, Mizu?
And I do think that that's a very important part when talking about a commander deck, is the fact that variance is such a huge thing in our format. You have to see if the deck is going to perform on its own before you can see if there's any errors in the deck.
Right.
What happens if you had your first game turn out not very well because you didn't draw enough lands? You can't say, oh, I need more lands
all
yet.
Entered tapped, so you know, you're 2 turns behind because every land is tapped, like, you know, or ETB is tapped.
But you also can't say, oh, I need to put in more lands immediately. It's just maybe I got a bad hand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So first thing is actively playing the decks and figuring out where you're struggling. If you're running a deck and you realize that you're running out of cards on like turn 4, turn 5, then you probably need more card advantage.
And one thing that took me a long time to learn in PDH is, I'm not even sure how to phrase it. Your deck, if your deck loses, which it will, every deck loses games, it's not always your deck. Like, sometimes if you join a random pod, maybe the deck you bring is just terrible against all 3 other decks. Like, matchup per matchup, maybe your deck is just bad against those decks. Like, it has nothing to do with the weaknesses of your deck. So it's easy to fall down that rabbit hole, like, damn, well, this deck sucks. Like, I keep losing with it, you know. You need to understand what your deck is trying to do necessarily, not like, oh, well, this is a weakness, you know, this is a bad card, this is a bad card. It may not be that. It may just be the matchup, the inherent matchups with the decks you're playing against, too. So that's just something to think about, something I go through. It took me a long time to learn that, actually.
Yeah, a big deal is making sure that anything that happens in a game, you have to not necessarily put it under a lot of scrutiny, but also give yourself the benefit of the doubt.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. Mm-hmm. What about you, Liam? How are you finding the weaknesses in your decks?
It just kind of depends. One of the big things that I do is when I'm actually, again, going back to deck construction and I'm making my final cuts, I kind of make like little notes, either in a notepad or on post-its, kind of like behind the card, so that when I'm evaluating my hand, I can be like, do I actually like this card that I picked, or would I have preferred this other card that does similar thing in its slot instead? And sure. So when I'm actually playing the deck and I'm evaluating, you know, I make little notes on those cards of like, okay, you know, in this one scenario, I did prefer this card, but in this other scenario, I preferred the other one. And if it ends up being like 50-50, I don't really consider that a weakness. I just consider that variance. But if it ends up being, you know, leaning one way of, no, I would much prefer this other card that I did not select, I consider that a weakness. Like, that's my way of finding weakness is just stats over time.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it, too. Like, I'll keep a running list on my phone of, like, okay, next time I get around to tinkering with, I don't know, Minthara, here's a bunch of cards that I want to test out. Yep. And then, like, over the next three or four times I play that deck, I'll identify cards that, like, okay, you can probably get swapped out for one of these other ones I'm testing, because the last two times I've cast you or last three times I've played this card, it's just been very underwhelming, so you're on the chopping block, exactly. Basically. What about you, Dave?
Something I used to do a lot more of when I played with sleeves and more of my decks was I would, if I was sort of undecided about a certain card, I would I would slip a little post-it note into the sleeve with the card, and the post-it note would always have the words like, am I sad that this card isn't, and then I would name a different card that I was thinking
That's exactly what I do, yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then so like that's just like a little reminder, because like it's easy to finish playing a game and being like, man, like I really needed more card draw. Like if that game had been exactly the same, but also I'd had two Lorien Revealeds in my hand, that would have been great. And you're like, well,
if I'd had two
Lorien Revealeds in my hand, in addition to all the cards that I actually drew normally, like then yeah. I think I would have been cheating because that's right. Too many cards. But also
possibly.
Like, which like you have to be very sort of mindful, like which card do you want to have not drawn? To have drawn Lorien Revealed instead. Like that's something that you have to be like it's something you have to be very mindful of, but it's something that's really hard to be mindful of in a 100 card single format. So these little post-it notes like help a lot when you're like it's less of this sort of like vague nebulous like, man, I wish I had more card draw, and it's more like very specific, I wish this card had been a different card instead. And like Liam said, like you have to do that a lot of times to see, like, you know, if you're consistently drawing Cleansing Wildfire and you think, man, I wish this card was a different cantrip, like that's fine, take it out. But like then sometimes you draw Cleansing Wildfire and you're like, this is exactly what I need right now,
right?
So like you have to be very there's a lot of like iterative refinement and a lot of like paying really close attention to what cards are performing for you and which cards are underperforming. Yeah, just a lot of mindfulness.
Yeah, and some of that trickles down into understanding, I mean, you know, it sounds silly, but like understanding what your specific deck does. Like, because of the nature of this format, you know, Dave and I can build the same commander and have two completely different decks. So if I'm having trouble with a particular aspect of my deck, I don't know if I want to run to Dave and be like, hey, how do you shore up your aggro matchup? Because his deck is completely different than mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your weaknesses are not going to be my weaknesses necessarily, because we share a commander and we probably share, you know, most of our land base, but that's going to be about it for the most part. So it's hard to understand what a weakness is in your deck without knowing its strengths, and you only know its strengths by playing that specific deck.
Yeah. The TLDR of all of this is you find weaknesses by playing 30 games with the deck.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like keeping track of when and how it loses and keeping track of when and how it wins, and accounting that some of that is just going to be variance. Sometimes you have a really good draw, sometimes you have a really bad draw, and like that's not an indictment of your deck or a reflection of your incredible skill. That's just
right.
RNG doing its thing, but like
that's the reason we play the game.
Yeah. But if you're paying really close attention and there's one card that's like constantly underperforming, or if there's, you know, one situation that's constantly popping up that you can't deal with.
Yep.
Like that's when you got to be like, well, something needs to change. How am I going to fix this?
Yep. Yep. Those are the two biggest ones. I think it's a situation you can't deal with, or a card that you continually have in your hand and then you die. Like a card you always die with in your hand. You're like, well, this needs to be something else completely.
Well, crap. That
well,
work.
Crap. Yeah, 100%. But I know we just talked about, like, hey, play your deck a lot. Play your deck a lot. I heard, Mizu, when you won with Scholar of the Ages, that was like the first time you played the deck.
It was like the second or third, but I did, in fact, build it that week.
Oh, wow.
That's fantastic.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
That's
now,
very
impressive. Now, have you always been kind of a, like, I could not pick up a new combo deck or new-to-me combo deck and, like, perform with it? Have you always, like, tinkered around with combo, or is just you just sort of like understand the lines pretty well?
Well, it one of the big things that helped with it is that I play High Tide in a lot of formats. So I already like know a lot of the things that High Tide needs in order to go for it. And it was just finding the shell around it.
Yeah, that's fair.
High Tide is a hell of a card.
High Tide is certainly a magic card.
It does things.
Yeah, it does. Oh, crazy things. So yeah, I think just repetition. Play your deck. Figure out, you know, and I do that all the time. You know, sometimes I'll be playing, you know, because when I do stream on Saturdays, I usually try to play two different decks. Sometimes, like, completely different opposite types of decks, like an aggro and then a control or whatever. A lot of times, like, if I'm playing two decks that share a color, like a Golgari deck and an Orzhov deck, sometimes I'll find stuff, like, in that Golgari deck that is performing fine, whether it's a spell or artifact or what have you, and that'll trigger something like, oh, I need to try this out in the Orzhov deck, you know, and I'll make a little note of it. And that's how I find a lot of my weaknesses, not weaknesses, I find a lot of cards that will fill gaps in other decks just by playing other decks. You know what I mean? Sometimes in the context of Orzhov, I may completely skip three or four black cards or white cards, but for some reason when I'm building Golgari, they're some of the first ones I add in there, and I just don't make that connection until I actually play with them in a different deck. And I'm like, oh, this actually would work very well in the weak spots I have in a completely other deck. I don't know if that made sense.
You're so used to a certain card being a Golgari card that you forget that it's just black and can go in either deck.
Right.
Yeah.
100%. 100%. It's a very good way to say that. Yeah. Happens all the time.
The struggle is real.
Yeah. The struggle is certainly real. So how do you patch up these weaknesses, Dave? Is that a thing? Or are you just, you're just like, my deck's just going to have these holes in it?
It is a thing. Fixing these holes is a... These are fixable problems. Yeah.
I guess it should be more like, how do you fix these weaknesses without going to like the opposite end of the spectrum? Like, oh, I need more land, so I'm going to add 5 or 10 more land. You know what I mean? Like, I need more mana, so I'm going to put in 8 more mana rocks. Like, how do you avoid overcompensating?
The ideal sort of fix-it maneuver that you're trying to go for is something that will correct a specific problem that you've been having sometimes while also being kind of modal. If you are struggling with land problems, adding more land might help. Adding more land cyclers might be... Adding more land cyclers without reducing the land count might be a better plan. Because in those rare games when you're not...
Sometimes that's a very good plan.
Yeah. Like if you're playing these games where you're not mana screwed and you don't need to cycle the Oliphant for Mountain, you can just play an Oliphant. It's a 6/4 that does things. The suite of land cyclers we've gotten in the last couple of years is nuts. If you are losing a lot to decks that involve land auras, like Cleansing Wildfire is a great inclusion. Like you could just put Sinkhole in your deck, but sometimes Sinkhole is just a dead card. Like not dead, but like the floor on Sinkhole is so low. Someone's got 10 lands and you're going to blow up one of them. Right. Like that's irrelevant. Like if you're not playing against the land auras, Sinkhole is bad.
Yep.
If you're not playing against land auras, Cleansing Wildfire still cantrips.
Yeah, still gets you a card back.
Right. It's like it basically cycles itself for 2. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like and maybe like even if you don't hit the land aura thing, maybe you catch like a Boros Garrison. Like that's still value.
Yeah, that's a tempo hit.
That's brutal.
Right. Yep. Like that's huge. Like Boomerang is sort of the same way. Like if you're losing to land auras, Sinkhole is not the answer. Boomerang is gonna be a very versatile answer to that specific problem. And like that's I think what you want to focus on. Like whenever you originally built this deck or whatever version of it you had before was presumably carefully thought out and meant to handle a variety of problems, and like something came up that you weren't prepared for, like you need to be able to add cards that will address that particular problem without damaging your ability to handle other problems. So like versatile answers, land cyclers to help fix your mana base.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, every time I play this, my commander gets pacified. Well, I'm going to add in disenchant. Like that's not exactly what you're saying. Like you're saying go for the cards that will add another avenue of play or just aren't dead in your hand if there are no enchantments to blow up.
Yeah, like disenchant is okay, but there's a 3-mana version that will disenchant or exile a card from your graveyard or reinforce one.
Right.
Broken exactly. Something, broken ties.
Yeah, broken ties.
Broken bonds. Broken ties, yeah. Right? Like that is going to be that card is going to fix that particular problem you have, or if you're playing in a game where you're not having that specific problem, it's going to do other things as well. And that, in my mind, makes it a lot more valuable than disenchant. So yeah, try to patch these weaknesses with cards that are very versatile in their ability to answer problems.
Yeah, that was a good lesson too. Like, I don't remember what deck it was, but this was a while ago, and I was having trouble. Like we sort of touched on earlier, I was having trouble with always being hellbent or finding like one card in my hand. Like I wanted a solid like draw spell, and I was going for just the rippers, you know what I mean? Just like divination, just like, you know, pay some mana, draw some cards, nothing fancy. And then I don't know why I didn't come upon this earlier, but then I was like, oh, why don't I just put Behold the Multiverse in all these decks, because it's phenomenal. You know,
Behold is a really good one.
So good. Like, it's a little more expensive than what I was casting, but for what it does, it's not truly modal like you were mentioning, but the value you get out of it is extremely, extremely powerful.
It's also a big deal when you can use it as like, hey, I just need to put this extra mana somewhere real quick. It's turn 3. Right, I have nothing to do with my 3 mana. Let me go ahead and pay for half of this card.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other thing I sort of was thinking about during this particular rant was the cards Thraben Inspector and Novice Inspector as weakness patching in Birdhorse to protect against Edicts. Like, if these are the cards you're running and you find yourself playing a game where you don't have to deal with Edicts, like, they also block and they replace themselves. So, like, at their floor, it's just a 1-mana cantrip, basically. You drop your 1-mana to put it into play. At the end of some turn cycle where you didn't need to spend all your mana, you crack the clue and it's replaced itself. And, like, you've lost nothing for having this card in your deck, basically.
Right. Yeah, and that's what makes them so good. Yeah, they're just so good.
Yeah.
And they're never really, like, dead. You know, turn 10, you drop a Thraben Inspector, you probably have the mana to automatically crack the clue. Like, let's go, draw another card. So,
yeah, like, at worst, it, you know, effectively cycles itself for 3 and leaves a body behind.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Skyscanner's not a great card, but it's a pretty good one. Just a 3-mana body that draws a card, like, that's fine.
It's kind of clutch sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially whenever you get to use the 2-mana at a later time.
Yeah. Yeah, the inspectors are phenomenally good cards. So yeah, this is like the things that you want to be thinking about as you patch your weaknesses. If you're looking at your Birdhorse list thinking like how do I protect against Edicts? Like if you say, well, I should add Mere Sire because that'll eat 2 Edicts. Like that's not thinking with portals. Like put in the Novice Inspector because that'll eat 1 Edict really well. And replace itself, and if you don't need it to eat an edict, it still replaces itself. Like that's thinking with portals.
Right. Yeah, it's that, I don't want to say next level thinking, but it is that sort of like almost out of the box type thinking. Because you're right, you know, Mere Sire is fun, you know, 2-mana, it's a 1/1, replaces itself with another 1/1, but like that's not really super where you want to be if you're in an edict meta, I wouldn't think, but...
That was a
good example.
If I knew for sure that I was going to be playing against Edicts every single game, I would definitely run Mere Sire over the Inspectors if it was guaranteed that I was going to square up against Edicts constantly.
Right.
Because it is, like, as an Edict deterrent, it is twice as good as Novice Inspector. Like, it eats... Novice Inspector eats 1 Edict, Mere Sire eats 2. The thing is, you don't know for sure. You need this amount of versatility because you can't guarantee that you're going to be playing against Conrad every single one of your games.
Yep.
Like you might end up in a game that's just, you know, Malcolm and Gretchen and Sphinx Summoner, And, like, Sphinx Summoner probably has one or two, like, Tithing Blade effects. But it's not going to, like, you don't
need...
It's
going to wreck your board.
Mirsire. Right. And if you're trying, like, if, you know, when you play Mirsire into Malcolm, like, that does nothing. That card is dead.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, an Inspector replaces itself and is slightly less dead. And that's the goal.
Slightly less dead. Yeah, and you can always kind of tell, too, because I don't know why we're stuck on Mirsire all of a sudden, but, like, Mirsire is one of those cards that if someone shows you their deck and you see it in there, your first question is, why is Mirsire in your deck?
Yeah.
It's just that type of card.
No one says that about Novice Inspector. They Correct. See Novice Inspector in the deck and you're like, oh, you know how to read. Like, good, we've established that.
We've established that much, yep. Oh, awesome. All right, Liam. So you've patched a couple weaknesses, you've filled in a couple slots, put in some better cards. How do you evaluate all these changes?
You really just kind of go with your gut. At least that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're actively criticizing... Sorry. When I am actively criticizing cards, that's when I'm keeping track of them. You know, that's when I'm keeping track of them. You know, would I rather have such and such? Or would I rather have this? How impactful was it? But once I make the swap, you know, if I'm satisfied with the swap, I'll kind of begin to ignore it unless I see a pattern arising. And that pattern could be directly related to the card, or it could just be related to the kind of card it is. You know, am I seeing that I have enough removal, or have I found that I don't have enough removal anymore? You know, maybe I've made so many swaps in a deck recently, and, you know, I cut too many lands. Right, because sometimes my deck list online will not reflect my deck list in paper.
Sure.
And so it's like, oh, you know, I'm actually 5 lands short than what this online deck list says. have done that before. So it really is, it's a little bit different to kind of reevaluate a deck without just starting over.
Yeah, sometimes it is difficult. What about you, Mizu? How do you evaluate your changes on a deck that you've been working on over time?
So one of the big deals about it is the same thing that we said earlier about weaknesses, is you've got to play a lot of lot of games with the deck, and really just pay attention to if those weaknesses are getting shored up. You're not going to see those cards that you just put in all the time, because again, we're in a singleton format, and unless you're playing Slime Against Humanity, you should only see your cards every so often.
Or something, right?
Yeah, a big deal of it is jamming all these extra games and saying, hey, I put in this Novice Inspector to help me out against Edicts. Do I feel like I'm stronger against Edicts after playing these 20 or so games?
And it's a longer process to find weaknesses in your deck than it is to be validated about changes you made, I've found. Like that first game you run into an Edict and you've got your Novice Inspector on board, you'd be like, yep, that was a good decision. But it probably took you, you know, 10 games to get to the point where you're like, man, I'm really struggling against Edicts. Like, let me figure out what to change here. But that first time it pays off, like, it feels big brain. It feels real good.
Something that my boyfriend and I sometimes do with his cube. So this doesn't work as well in a multiplayer format like PDH, but when...
Sure.
He has this cube that's, you know, significantly smarter than both of us, which is wild to mess around with. And when he tinkers with it, he's like, I've changed around what blue and green is doing as a draft archetype in this cube, and I want to mess with it. He'll just sort of like put together what he thinks is a reasonably drafted blue green deck, and he'll play with that. And, you know, so we'll skip some of the RNG in getting there. This is the kind of blue-green deck that I think someone would draft. I'm just going to pull those cards out, and we'll play a couple games. And we'll see how this performs. Or, like, even on a card-by-card basis, he'll be like, I made this one swap. I want to play a couple games, but I'm going to start with this card in my hand during each of those games for science. And I
Oh, yeah, for sure. For
heck
sure.
Yeah, I love science. So, like, in these one-on-one environments, if you get, you know, friends that are, like, really dedicated to science and playtesting and, like, helping you refine these things iteratively, you can kind of skip the RNG bit and be like, you know, if I have access to this card, is it doing what I want it to do? Mm-hmm. And then the next step in that is, like, you know, if I shuffle this card in my deck, am I getting it as often as I need it?
Yeah.
So those are both things that I think Mizu nailed it, you know. You evaluate the weakness, the weakness shoring up bit the same way that you discover the weaknesses in the first place, which is just play 27 games with a deck and see what happens. Yeah.
And if you're, you know, I've done this before. I don't do it all the time, but if it's for a card that I'm particularly concerned about or even excited about or what have you, you know, I'll hop on Moxfield and use the Goldfish playtest feature, and I'll just mulligan until I get that card in my opening hand.
Sure.
And just sort of, like, see what it feels like after my first land drop, second land drop, yada, yada, yada. So it's kind of tedious, but sometimes I've done that before just to sort of see how it feels.
You can just find any keepable hand, and then instead of drawing for your first turn.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Hit the view library button and just put it into your hand.
Just go grab it.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a bad idea, because most times it's almost always a creature of like 1 to 2 mana. Something cheaper than my commander is like almost always the cards that I change out for some reason. So I'm always like, okay, I need to, you know, I would like this on the board before my commander comes out, or I want my commander on board before I cast this creature just to see how they interact, that sort of thing. But yeah, I never thought about doing that with Cube. That's really clever. The science is good there.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go here? Oh yeah, Dave put in, you get your face caved in, and afterward think, maybe I should do something about that.
Yeah, I was,
that helps too.
I was a little confused about what section we were. I meant to.
Yeah, I feel like that should have been in the section right above it.
Yeah, how do you find weaknesses? You get your face caved in, and afterwards you think to yourself, maybe I should do something about that?
About all the face kicking.
All the face kicking. And, Mizu added, my Pillar 4 was not good enough and needs to be less not good.
Yes, hashtag less not good.
Less not good.
Yep. My only... I don't even know if this is on the list here. When is the whole deck the weakness? Like, how long does it take you to realize, wow, this is just not working? Like, it wasn't variance. I didn't just lose a few games in a row or what
happened. The deck is just bad.
Like, this whole deck just isn't working. Yeah. Yeah. Because we've all been there. I think I'm a little too quick. I jumped to that trigger a little too quickly, you know, faster than most players. But.
Oh, I will assure you, Brad, that you are. I am the quickest deck thrower away in the format.
Quickest draw in the West.
Yeah, I've taken decks apart on Saturday streams after they've lost. Like, I lose game one, I'm like, this was terrible. And I just take it apart until, watching the rest of the game end.
Wow.
So I think a big deal with that one is making sure, as you're in the game, that the weakness in the deck is not just the deck isn't doing anything. It's a really big deal for your deck to feel
that's
like
easily
it's
fixable.
Involved.
Like you can make your deck do stuff. Yep.
If you come to the end of that game and you go, "Dang, if I wasn't at the table, nothing would have changed," then I don't think that's a weakness in a card selection. That might be a weakness in the deck itself.
That's actually a pretty good, like, sort of internal question to ask. Did I make any impact on this game whatsoever?
Now, I will say that question is more for casual games than it is in competitive. Because let's just say that it's Sanctuary 3, you're in the finals, and Gator wins on turn 3.
Yep, all the other three decks just sucked is what it comes down to, I think. They were just terrible.
Yeah, I think that trying to figure out if the weakness... Like, I'm kind of with Liam on this one. Liam's earlier input to this conversation where he said that he just builds bad decks. Like, I'm kind of in the same boat. Like, most of my decks are bad. So, like, when they lose a game, great. Like,
right.
That is the intended outcome. Perfect. We nailed it. Like, when I have taken apart a deck, it is because that deck has become so consistent that it is boring to me. And that the deck just does the thing every time. Mm-hmm. And like I take apart a deck when it has no more surprises left.
That's fair.
So like Blaze Commando, Viscopa Guildmage, like there was nothing that those decks could do anymore to like interest me.
Right.
And like they were great decks. They overperformed constantly and I just got bored of it. So like most of my decks are not trying to win. They're trying to do the thing. So if someone else is like when I'm patching up weaknesses in those decks, it's finding ways to make that thing happen or finding ways to stop people from preventing me from doing that thing.
Let me do my thing.
Let me do the thing. And like, yeah, so like, yeah, in like the Phoenix land beating deck, for example, the, mm-hmm. the one with all, you know, it's got the indestructible artifact lands, and then it animates them with Zendikons and then attacks with them. Like, the weakness in that deck is you end up with, like, one, like, 8/8 indestructible creature, and that comes at the expense of one of your lands. So you're basically, like, you could still tap it for mana, but, like, you don't want to. You want to tap it during combat. And, like, the deck doesn't have a lot of other creatures. So, like, making that deck be really consistent, like, the cards that are, like, sleeper hits in that deck that just make it really consistent and patch up a lot of its weaknesses in really sort of unexpected ways are things like Core Halberd.
Yeah.
Just a one-mana vigilance equipment mm-hmm. that lets you, you know, have this 8/8 indestructible thing to block with as well. Like, that's huge. Giving these guys vigilance is, like, way more important in this deck than in any other deck. Mm-hmm. And, like... the deck has 40 lands and still runs a lot of ramp because you are turning your lands into attackers.
Yeah.
And you like you need to be like replacing those lands with other things that generate mana because like you're losing that mana when you're attacking with this thing. Like in that deck, I don't need to win. I just want to, you know, I want to be able to yeet these lands. I want to send
show
the lands.
Off my big fat lands. Yep.
Exactly. And like the things that were preventing me from doing that effectively were a lack of vigilance on the big fat lands and a lack of mana acceleration, which I didn't think was like when I first built the deck, I was like, all right, I've got 40 lands. Like I probably don't need a ton of rocks. Like, no, I needed a lot of rocks.
I still needed rocks. Yep.
I needed rocks. I needed Navigation Orb. I needed Cleansing Wildfire and Geomancer's Gambit to be ramp spells for me because all my lands are indestructible. Like I needed Heliod's Pilgrim to be a blocker that put a Zendikon into my hand. Yeah, just a lot of stuff like that.
And that just comes from playing the deck a million times.
Yeah.
So. Hey guys. Hey right, listeners. I just want to let you know the main theme of the episode is actually just play your decks more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We could have had a 3-minute episode, but we want to stretch it out a little bit.
Well,
easy.
Yeah. How do you find and patch weaknesses in your deck? Play them while paying attention.
Yeah. Take notes if you have to. And that'll wrap it up for the week.
I have a giant stack of post-it notes that I leave right next to my play area. Mm-hmm. Like I will attach sticky notes to cards. I'll attach them to decks. I'll attach them to commanders. Like I write down things compulsively on these notes all the time. I go through a lot of sticky notes.
Yeah, my notepad on my phone is like that too. I'm constantly putting in notes, putting in tips and that sort of thing. Yep.
I spend enough time.
Even like between game or if it's, you know, a Saturday stream game and one player is taking a particularly long turn for whatever reason, I'll grab my phone and like make a note like, okay, you know, minus tapped lands, add more basics, like just simple stuff like that. So I don't forget it basically. Cause I've done that before too, where I played a deck and I'm like, oh yeah, I got to change this land around or do this, change this creature, yada, yada, yada. And I don't make a note of it. And then I forget. And then I play the deck again. And I'm just like, what am I doing to myself every time? Like, so I started making notes of everything.
I spend more time on my computer than I do on my phone, but I still want my notes to be accessible on both. So like,
sure.
I use the drafts folder in my Gmail account as my note.
Oh, look at you. That's like, clever.
It currently has 484 drafts that it thinks are unsent emails, but I know are notes to myself.
Note to self. Cards.
Yeah.
All right. Second to last bullet point, Liam, we'll start with you. How do you don't have a ton of decks, but how do you iterate over multiple decks over time? How do you keep up on them? How do you watch them? How do you make changes to them all with everything we've sort of talked about already?
It will often be I'm not doing 70 deck updates at once.
Fair.
I will focus on one or two that I'm iterating on and I'm tinkering with. And I'll either get them to a place I like, or I'll get them to a place I really don't like, and I'll dismantle them. Hmm. But every 6 months or so, I like to take a weekend and sit down and do the big update of like, okay, what has come out over the past couple of months? What has actually been impactful that I might want to test out? What do I feel like people are missing, right? And kind of slot into my own decks. But overall, iterating over multiple lists is not something I do very often. If that makes sense.
Sure.
Like I'll have like one deck that I'll iterate on. Right now, that is Graceblade, where like I'm just swapping like a pile of auras in and out and out. It's just it's more just to give myself variance because there's just so many auras that I want to play that I just don't have room for.
I know, right? There's so many good ones.
And there really isn't any real end goal or intention with that. And the deck that I'm about to iterate on again for like the fourth time is Yuggle. I keep saying I need to rebuild it. I just need to rebuild it. I need to sit down and rebuild it. Because right now it's I have the majority of the cards. It's just in piles elsewhere because I like pulled it apart for other decks that now no longer exist. So I just need to put Yuggle back together. But yeah, iteration for me can look like a couple things. It can look like over time small changes. It can look like big batch changes every couple months. Or it could look like, this is the fourth time I'm building this deck because I keep rebuilding it and dismantling it over and over and over and over.
What about you, Mizu? How do you work on multiple decks over time?
The way that I like to do it is I will stay in the same deck list, make my changes, and in your primer section, specifically on Moxfield, I will detail all of the changes that I made with a little tag next to it that's like version 1, version 1.2. And whenever you have a big update, version 2.1.
Yeah, because it's something that changes the deck
fundamentally.
Entirely, almost. Yeah, fundamentally.
But keeping track of all the different changes in case it doesn't work out and you can go back and start it all over again.
Yeah, that's a pretty good process, too. I never really thought about using the primer as almost just like your history, you know, if you will, of the deck itself. Because you can look at your history, but sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle, you know? Like, it's a little hard to dig back through weeks and weeks and weeks of changes just to figure out what you did. Oh, Dave, I don't think you need to explain your whole process, but it is impressive. Is that something like, did you just like hit Moxfield running with that process, or is that something you sort of like sat down and thought out and worked on and you're like, this is how I need to do things, or did it just sort of like come organically?
I started doing it when I hit about the 50 deck threshold.
So it was more of like necessity.
Yeah. I try really, really hard to like, I've put a lot of effort into organizing the whole technique, and because I want, like, I see Blake just kind of does things, and like, it's very like, you know, he doesn't track any of the changes he makes. Like, he doesn't maintain any like online lists. He's just like, you know, like, he doesn't, you know, when a new set comes out, he doesn't like look through it. He'll just like, he'll be, you know, handling the cards at a pre-release, and he's like, oh, this one looks interesting, and he'll just like put it in his pocket. And then like later, if he finds it, he'll be like, oh yeah, I wanted to put this in a deck. And then he'll just like, he'll like handle the deck and be like, this one has ugly art, and he'll take it out and he'll put that one in, and he'll be like, there's no system here. What is happening?
No system. And like, no system at all.
I love that he is capable of that. I like admire how sort of laissez-faire he is with it and just like, you know, go with the flow. But like, I can't do that. I need everything to be very structured and very organized and very documented, so that I know, like, it's just that I can track everything and I know what has changed and what hasn't. My tip for doing this is, if you abandon all of your other pursuits in life, like having friends and being social, then you'll have more time to stare at Moxfield lists for 6 hours a day.
Yeah, without ever stopping.
Without ever stopping, yeah.
Yeah, that is sage wisdom right there. Yeah.
It's time to quit my job and be a full-time PDH deck builder.
Absolutely.
I can support this whole maneuver.
Yeah, I'm pretty, I don't know. I'm kind of messy with my, I have a system, but it's like purposely disorganized almost. Like I won't go through the Moxfield like Dave does. But I try to keep up on all my decks at all the time. Like when new cards come out, or when I'm just surfing Scryfall and I see something that looks cool, I'll make a note of it. Like, hey, try this out in whatever, Spiritmonger, I don't know, whatever deck. And then I'll look through my bulk and I'll try them out and I'll get them. If I don't have them, cool. That's a reason for me to go to the shop and look for cards. That's a reason for me to make orders, you know, even if it's 2 cards or 50 cards or whatever. Like, I'm always thinking about ways to not just change my decks for the sake of changing them, but I'm always trying to keep in mind that, like, hey, last time I played XYZ deck, or the last 2 or 3 times I played it, I really struggled against these particular things that my opponents were doing. So I've kept two or three cards in mind, and I'm just going to go ahead and put them in there. But a lot of the problem with that is I will forget that other decks want those cards. Like, I bought four Extract Confessions for various decks, forgetting that I actually have, like, seven decks that want that card. So then I had to make another order for Extract Confession. And in the meantime, I built a new deck that wanted Extract Confession, so I actually had to go get another one. Like, there's no organization. But, like, I'm okay because I just like to buy cards. So I'm kind of cool with it. But I try to keep track of it. I try to remember. I try to take notes. I'm not great about doing Moxfield stuff as far as, like, tracking your history goes. But I don't know. It's fun. I just like cards. So I end up forcing myself to just go and look at cards and order more cards and that sort of thing. So, but I do, to my best ability, I do try to keep up on as many decks as possible. Not necessarily every set, but regularly enough. Like, especially if I know, because with my Saturday streams, I try to plan out at least 2 to 3 weeks in advance. Like, okay, I'm going to play these two decks this coming Saturday. I'd like to play these two decks the following Saturday, and then unless something changes, I'll play these two decks that third Saturday. So I try to, like, keep those as up to date as possible, mainly for my own sanity, you know, so I'm not playing, like, the same decks over and over and over again. But so yeah, it's kind of a messy system, but I feel like it's a system. Maybe it's not really. Maybe I just tell myself that.
Seems like it.
But if, even if it's not a system, I still get to buy cards all the time.
That's
or hunt for them, dig for them, or whatever.
If only we were in an accessible format where it's okay to buy 15 copies of the same card.
I know, right? It's like you got to justify it sometimes.
Hey, look, even in the inaccessible formats of EDH, they still do that crap.
Yeah, but I don't feel as bad justifying a 38-cent purchase compared to a $45 one.
Compared to a $38 yep. purchase.
Right, exactly. Oh, crazy. No thanks. All right, last bullet point, and then I think we've got a decent listener question for the week, and then we'll get on out of here. Last one up. Mizu, have you ever cut a card from a deck because it's been terrible or just didn't synergize or whatever, only to bring it back into the deck later on? Or, like, if you get rid of a card, it's just gone forever?
I personally like to make a little sideboard or a maybe board of cards that I cut. Mm-hmm. Even if it isn't for a specific reason. So let's just say that you're going into this new, you're going to a tournament. You think that there's going to be a lot of aggro. So you take out cards that are bad against aggro. And then you find out that it was a lot of control or combo. You don't want to sit there and go back and dig through and look for those cards that you already had. You just want to go ahead and, hey, look, I can put these right back into the list. Keeping in, like, a list of the stuff is good. Oh. Sorry.
Yeah. No, you're totally fine. What about you, Dave? Are cuts final in your world?
Not even a little bit. So, I have my decks in little boxes, and inside each of these boxes, there's a penny sleeve in which I put all of the cards that I've recently cut. It's because I want them to be right next to the deck in case I am playing with a new card, and I'm like, man, I wanted to try out this new card, but it turns out it sucks. Like, I can easily swap something right back because I have, you know, I have a little maybe board that just sticks around. Super convenient. If the penny sleeve, if the penny sleeve gets too full, then I'll go through and I'll do a purge and I'll be like, I haven't thought about or wanted to play this card in years. Like, you can go get sorted back into the general collection, but
go get wrecked.
Yeah.
Stupid card.
Like, I get weirdly sentimental about it. Like, I never think get wrecked stupid card. I think, like, I'm glad that you spent, you know, these last 2 years in the Dex box with this deck because I have memories that associate you with this deck, but, like, it doesn't need to happen anymore. Like,
it's your time.
You've done your time. Like, please go back in the general collection. You no longer need to be in this particular penny sleeve in this particular deck box.
I have decks like that, not many, maybe like one or two that I built forever ago and I just haven't played in a long time, but I won't take them apart because of that, like what you just said.
yeah
it's weird.
Yeah, like I there are certain cards that I just like, so there's a handful of cards that I know that I should take out of decks because they're bad. Mm-hmm. but I get really sentimental about it. And I'm like, no, this, like, this card is something that I just identify with the deck really strongly. Like, I don't want to take it out. And like, for there's a lot of times, like, me putting it into the penny sleeve instead is like my compromise, because it stays with the deck box. It stays nearby. Like, I can look at it.
Not
and
like
I can
an official thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I can still do that, like, nostalgic association with this old card in this deck, and like just have it nearby.
Yep.
And without actually like having it in the deck, making the deck like function worse. So like, yeah, TLDR, I'm like weirdly sentimental about pulling cards out of decks.
Yeah, totally. I totally understand that. What about you, Liam? Are cuts final in the world of the PDH PhD?
No, absolutely not. And I actually hilariously do the same exact thing that Dave does. It just depends on the deck. Maybe there is a penny sleeve, maybe there isn't. Kind of just depends how many cuds have been cut and I was chilling out in the deck box. But I want to latch on to the recent cuts comment, because I'm looking at an EDH deck right now that's got about 30 cards in the maybe board that all at one point in time were in the deck and just got pushed out, not because they're bad, but because just new cards came out that I wanted to try, and I was like, ah, this is a 20-year-old classic. I've played tons. I can push this card out for the new card. And it's
so
just...
if you guys had, like, you and Dave, and maybe Mizu too, so if you had a Black X deck or Mono Black deck or what have you, and Tithing Blade comes out, and you're like, cool, I really want to test Tithing Blade out. Whatever card you swap out for Tithing Blade, like, you'll keep separately? You don't just, like, throw it back in the bulk?
Nope, it just stays in the deck box.
Stays in the deck.
Okay.
I should adopt that.
The card on my Moxfield profile goes into the sideboard. My physical card goes back into the bulk.
Okay, so you're like in the middle of that. Okay.
The physical card goes into my deck box, and I don't even acknowledge the Moxfield sideboard.
The Moxfield sideboard is where I keep cards that I want to add.
I just don't even acknowledge it.
it's the way that I've tracked the cards that I want to put in the deck versus the cards that I've actually added to the physical deck.
Sure.
Like it's like a flag for me. But yeah, I put cards that
should I should adopt that, because I will get a new shiny card from Outlaw to Thunder Junction or whatever, and I'll slot it into a deck and I'll forget what I took out for it.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, well, this card doesn't really pan out. I want to put back in what was in there. And then I don't remember what was in there.
Yeah, someone on Discord yesterday was asking me about my Allura Dragon Cultist deck. And so I pulled it up. I sent them the link. And then, like, because it was pulled up, I was just looking at it. And I was like, man, a bunch of these cards are bad. Like, now that I'm thinking about them. And, like, right then, like, you know, I was on the train, on my phone, miles away from my collection, these cards. Like, I couldn't, there's nothing I could do about any of it, but I was like, I ought to make some of these changes, and like being able to, like, you know, use little flags and indicators within Moxfield that tell me what changes I want to make the next time I have those cards in my hands is like, that's very helpful for me to stay organized.
That's
sure.
So like, that's too much.
I added some cards to the sideboard. Those are the cards that I'm going to put in when I get a chance. And I changed the tags on some of the cards from whatever group they were in. The words cut me. Those are the cards I'm going to take out for them.
Yeah, I like that grouping. Now, I do use sideboard on Moxfield for cards that I want to try out or, you know, add to the deck or what have you. It's just once I make that swap in paper, I just completely forget what I took out for it eventually. Like, it'll show up. Like, I could dig through the history of the Moxfield list, but crazy. I didn't realize there were so many different ways to organize cuts and cards and decks and everything else. It's fairly impressive.
I've been working on it for a long time.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, you definitely have. Yeah, I like your process. It's very detail-oriented, very, like, organized, just very structured and organized. I like that quite a bit. I don't know if I could pull it off, but it is admirable for sure.
The drawback is that it takes 8 million...
a hot minute, as they say.
Well, I think it would take significantly less time if there was less decks.
We don't talk like that in the
that does not compute. Like, yeah.
I'm just saying, I have three decks on my Moxfield, and it takes me about 30 seconds to update.
I don't know which of your handlers you on your appearance show, but like they must have got to tell you that we don't. We don't make suggestions in front of Alcadron about maybe having fewer decks. It's
it was all in your paperwork. It was right there in the contract.
Yeah. No, I probably
awesome.
Yeah, it would go faster if I had fewer decks, but I'm.
But no.
I don't have anything better to do with those 12 hours of my day.
You needed something to do.
Good conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, y'all have anything you want to add to the scoping out weaknesses problem in your decks? Did we miss over anything? Did we gloss over anything you want to talk about?
I hit everything I'd want to talk about.
Yeah, I feel great.
Yeah. Good deal. Well, I don't know about the listeners, but at least Liam and I have been teased with this listener question for like a solid week. And Mizu's been wondering about it for days. Dave, hit us.
So, 11 days ago, okay. Infamous Fridge, remarkable deck builder, amazing player, love this guy. Mm-hmm. He DM'd me a question that I got really excited about, and we didn't have time to talk about it in the last episode, because last episode was a lot. But we're doing it right now. And the question is this. It's a two-part question. First part, who wins a battle royale? Hill Giant, Ogre Warrior, Tor Giant, or Trans Guild Courier?
Ooh.
Give me the options again.
Spicy.
Hill Giant, a 4-mana vanilla 3/3.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Ogre Warrior, a 4-mana vanilla 3/3. Tor Giant, a 4-mana vanilla 3/3 from Ice Age. Mm-hmm. I should say, I think Ogre Warrior is from Portal, Hill Giant's from Alpha. Or Trans Guild Courier, a 4-mana vanilla 3/3 from Ravnica.
That is a very interesting question.
This is why I liked it so much. You don't get to make this decision based on their stats, because they all have the exact same stat block.
They do. They're all 4-mana 3/3s.
You have to make this decision based on their art and their flavor text.
In a battle royale, my vote is going to go for Ogre Warrior.
Did you read the flavor text on Ogre Warrior? That's pretty
good.
And
look at that axe. Well-known fact about Mizu in the community is that if you give me any creature with a big weapon, I will adore it more.
See? There you go. It's got a big toothy grin. Like, come on. It's... Assault and battery included. That's my warrior.
It's very hard to argue with Jeff Miracola. He does remarkable work.
What about you, Liam? Who's your 4-mana 3/3 of choice?
I have never played with any of these cards, and I just found out about three of them.
Nice.
I'm not entirely sure. Part of me is like, well, clearly the Trans Guild Courier, because it doesn't die to Doomblade.
Well, that's fair.
But it does die to the one that kills artifacts.
Shatter, yeah.
Yeah, it does get shattered.
Yeah.
I will say that... But it
also doesn't die to the one that kills non-artifact creatures. Go for the Throat. So it survives Doomblade and it survives Go for the Throat, but it does die to Shatter.
It can
also be played in any deck you want to play it in.
That's true. Colorless does help.
Or is it five colors?
It's five colors.
It's
five colors.
Yeah,
I will say that specifically the 5th edition Hill Giant art does give it a run for my money.
Specifically,
is that the lady?
Fifth?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the giant lady with like a wolf in the background?
It's an elk.
An elk in the background.
Yeah.
That is good art.
Charles Gillespie.
Yeah, that one's good.
I think in the end, I'm going to go with the warrior strictly for the warrior subtype.
Okay. A little errata action. All right. Yeah. What about you, Dave? Who's your giant of choice?
I really like Tor Giant.
Fair.
The art of Tor Giant is very nostalgic.
For me. Extremely.
Like it's based on the art. It looks like the least like martial of them. Like the art suggests that this is just some like tired guy who's kind of cold.
Yeah.
And like has great facial hair but is otherwise bald. Like there's nothing even in the art that suggests that he's a giant.
Because even the mountains and trees and stuff are like at a distance.
They're so far in the distance. Like, this could just be some guy. Like, maybe he's like 7 feet tall, and you're like, all right, like, you're a big guy, Tor Giant. Like, what are you?
It's like a candid photo. Like, he was walking with someone, and they're like, hey, look over your shoulder, and snapped a picture. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's all grumpy from being cold.
Yeah. Like, Hill Giant, I think, is. Like, it's a little older for me, and there's a nostalgia embedded in that, but, like, Hill Giant has had, like, a dozen printings with, like, four different arts, so it feels like it's become much more of a... It felt like it was relevant for a lot longer. Tor Giant has one printing. It was from Ice Age. After that, they were done with Tor Giant. Like,
it said done. It's over.
Yeah.
Fair. Good argument.
Maybe he doesn't win the Battle Royale, but, like, he's the guy that I would, like, hang out with.
Yeah.
Like, I want to like hang out on my porch with this guy and have a beer. Which brings us to this.
Go ahead. If you're gonna win a battle royale, I think you have to do it off sheer brutality and insanity. And that's just ogre warrior for me.
Yeah, in that case, definitely ogre warrior. Ogre warrior's got this one in the bag for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Part two. What do we got?
Part two of this question. Who makes the best waffles?
Okay. What are the choices?
Hill Giant, Ogre Warrior, Tor Giant.
Same ones.
Ooh. That's rough.
That's a much harder question. I don't think Tor Giant has time for that. I just don't think he has time for waffles.
You know what? I think it's Trans-Guild Courier.
Yeah? Okay. Explain yourself.
Because, first off, look at this guy. He knows how to check the timer on a waffle. He also looks like he'd be really good at delivering them.
Well, that's for sure.
He is a courier.
Yes, a courier. Very nice posture.
This is a compelling argument.
And it looks I'm like he already has like a little spatula in his hand to like pull it off of the.
I'm definitely going to go with the golem, who's going to be very punctual and not burn the waffles.
Yeah, it might be the courier.
I feel like the courier is the only one of these four that like has a job.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Yeah, the others just live off the land.
Yeah. I'm feeling the courier.
Yeah, same here. Now that I rethink about it, the Tor Giant, you know, he may know some like campfire, deep forest way to make like the best waffles you've ever had, or he just may not even know what a waffle is.
Before Mizu graced us with his wisdom, I was thinking Tor Giant, like mostly because like as a young man with functioning knees. I did a lot of snowboarding. Like, I'm not that person anymore.
Okay.
But as a young man with functioning knees, I did a lot of skiing and snowboarding. And so, like, every ski and snowboard hill I've been on has, like, there's one run where there's just, like, the waffle shack in the middle of the hill where you can just go and... So, like, I've always associated with waffles with, like, cold.
Mm-hmm.
And Tor Giant just reminds me of that. Like the art, like he's in the cold. He's, you know, you can see his breath is steaming.
So not like, that he makes good waffles, but he needs to eat a waffle, a nice hot waffle right now.
Yeah.
Or maybe okay. Tor Giant is the person running that waffle shack.
Maybe Tor Giant runs the waffle shack on the ski hill.
Maybe. I still think the courier gets it though.
Yeah, I
think. Seems like a unanimous decision.
Yeah. I think that Mizu laid that out really well. I think it's going to be Trans-Guild Courier as the best waffle maker.
I think so, too. I think those are excellent questions by Mr. Fridge.
Yeah. Thank you, Fridge.
Fridge asking the real questions, Fridge. That everyone wants to know.
The realest questions.
The realest ones. Yeah, and if any other listeners want to hit us with some real, real questions, too, just get in the Discord, shoot us an email or what have you. Yeah, we'll get them on air. Clearly, we'll answer questions about any damn thing. So...
It's true.
Anything else before we wrap it up for the week? You guys got anything?
I'm out. I'm spent.
Out. Spent. Awesome. We do have a few more things before we get out of here for the week. If you need more Pauper Commander talk or have any questions about the format, you can follow us on Instagram and X. We are just the PDH Pod on those platforms. Or you can email the show at thepdhpod@gmail.com. Or you can head on over to the PDH Homebase's website. That'll take you to their Discord server. You'll find all of us. You'll find Mizu Sun. Probably get in some games. If the listeners want to find you anywhere else, Mizu, where are you?
You can find me on Discord at MizuSun. I'm in the home base. I'm in Sanctuary. I'm a big person in the PDH Pod Patreon. chats.
Yes. Love having you.
If you want to find me on Twitter or X, I am at _Mizu_Sun. And that's about it.
No, that's perfect. That's the perfect amount of socials. You can also find Liam and I on Twitter or X, whatever, at PauperCommand and Pauper_B. And as always, you can find Dave as the Alcadron just about anywhere else waffles are being talked about. I'll put all the links to all the social stuff down in the show notes if you want to check those out. We will get back to you with confirmation on the next Sanctuary event, but the Common Cause was verified for the 27th of April.
27 is Common Cause, yeah.
Yep, excellent. Same rules as before. Proceeds go to charity. And it'd be a good time. We'll have more info about it. You can head on over to omgmtg.com for extra information, sign up, and all that sort of good thing, timing, the entry fee, and all that sort of good stuff. So check that out. But the link will be in the show notes as well. And I think that's going to do it for us for episode 92 of the PDH Pod. But before we come to a close, we got to give a big thanks to MTG Brad for letting us use their original music for the show. And from everyone in here to everyone out there, brew a deck, play some PDH, and we'll see you in about a week. Say bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Peace.
Cheers. I brought Pumper Text to the party. Pumper. I brought Pumper Text to the party.